Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to be talking today about the history of Wisconsin with Erica Janik of Madison, the author of a new book called A Short History of Wisconsin. It is published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press, and we're pleased to have Erica here with us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Where did history first happen in Wisconsin?
It's a good question. Well, like most places in North America and maybe around the world, our history really happened around our waterways. This really provided areas, ways for people to get around. Some of the most fertile ground for farming was right along our river valleys and waterways. It also obviously provided some good drinking water, so it was an attractive place for people to come and to live. So all along our state, you know, we have a lot of water here in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. So people were coming through the lakes and down our rivers, and that's really where all of our first, both Indian and white settlers first came.
The person considered the first European explorer in Wisconsin is recognized as Nicolet, as he landed in Green Bay. However, there's another French explorer that probably was the first person to touch land in Wisconsin, and that was years earlier.
That's right. The value of writing things down, where you actually went and what you did, means you often get recognized as the first person. Etienne Bruel probably came to Wisconsin a couple years earlier. He came in 1622. He was sent by Samuel de Champlain, who was the governor of New France, which is Canada. He was sent to find a river route or a water route to the Pacific. And we know that he was in Lake Superior, like I said, in 1622, 1623, but he didn't write down whether he landed anywhere. He probably did. It's unlikely he stayed on water the whole time. Mm-hmm. But because he didn't write it down, as I said, Nicolet gets all the credit. He landed at Red Banks, which is near Green Bay, in 1634. And he didn't end up, he was also sent on that same mission as Bruel to find that water route to the Pacific. And he didn't end up finding that route, but he did meet a lot of Ho-Chunk Indians. And he found a pretty rich source of beaver furs that provided a lot of lovely hats to European aristocrats.
Mm-hmm. If you'd like to join this conversation, the number for you is 1-800-642-1234. Our email address, talk@wpr.org, talking with Erica Janik, the author of A Short History of Wisconsin. What prompted you to write the book? Let's go back to the beginning here.
Yeah, I had been working at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and we did a digital project called Turning Points in Wisconsin History. This was really, I think we started working on this in 2004. This was really geared at teachers and students to learn more about state history using documents about our history. And the Wisconsin Historical Society is obviously a rich source of these documents. And so we were scanning documents from the archives and writing essays on state history. And meeting with a lot of teachers who said, you know, that they would really love to, you know, they don't always have internet access in their classroom, and they'd really love a book that they could send home with their students. And then we just started thinking that, you know, there really isn't a really compact history of Wisconsin. And so it kind of grew out of those two impulses, responding to a need that teachers expressed about wanting to have a state history written by someone living in Wisconsin about Wisconsin that they could use in their classrooms and send home with their kids, but also just having something fun for a general reader to learn more about their state in a way that's not daunting. You know, it's mm-hmm. a pretty compact book that covers a lot of ground, gives you the basics on this place.
Wisconsin did participate in the War of 1812 with the building of Fort Shelby on, is it Somfriol
yep.
Island of Bardachin? Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, we don't often think sometimes that the War of 1812, most of the things you hear about it, Wisconsin doesn't really come up much when you hear about it. We actually did have a battle in the War of 1812. It was fought on July 1814 in Prairie du Chien. The British actually gained control of the area, but they held on to it for a few months, renamed the fort that had been called Fort Shelby. They renamed it Fort McKay. And after the British lost the War of 1812, the area went back to the Americans. The war was really important, though, because the United States had actually gained control of Wisconsin and the upper Midwest, which was then known as the Northwest, after the American Revolution. But the Americans had been, you know, kind of busy writing their constitution and doing a lot of things on the eastern seaboard, and they'd kind of ignored the Midwest. And this kind of allowed the British to just keep control of the area. Most of the people living in Wisconsin at the time were French fur traders and the Indians who were much more concerned with what was going on in Canada and in Europe than what was going on in Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. So when the War of 1812 actually broke out, most of the people that were living in Wisconsin actually sided with the British. They weren't terribly sympathetic to the Americans, who had basically ignored them for the last couple decades since they gained control of the area. Mm-hmm. But the War of 1812 and then this battle in 1814 really taught the Americans that they needed to pay attention to this area. They needed to defend it because the British were not going away otherwise. And so after the war, they built a chain of forts that went from Canada all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. Three of these forts were in Wisconsin. One of them is Fort Howard in Green Bay. Then there's Fort Winnebago at Portage and Fort Crawford at Prairie du Chien.
The war taught us that we had to do some protecting of the borders then.
Right. Yeah, that this area needed protecting. Before, I think they had just thought, you know, it'll be all right. We'll just let them take care of themselves. But, you know, the British were still here. They were still doing business. The people who were living here weren't loyal to the Americans at all, which is not good when you're trying to build up your country and people that are living in half of your country aren't loyal to you at all. So it really, you know, gave them the idea that, you know, if they were going to control this area and have it be part of the United States, then it was worthy of their defense.
How many attempts to achieve statehood failed before the measure became law? I was unaware that there was more than one.
Yeah, Wisconsin became a territory in 1836, and basically from the beginning, people had been advocating to get us to become a state. There were four formal attempts before it was finally decided that Wisconsin could move from becoming a territory to a state, and that happened in 1846. You need 60,000 people in order to become a state. In 1836, when Wisconsin became a territory, we had about 11,000 people. By 1846, though, we had over 150,000 people. So more than enough to become a state. So it's kind of surprising that it took four different attempts in order to actually get this through the legislature, because being a state has a lot of power and prestige that being a territory doesn't have. Mm-hmm. So a lot of politicians and businessmen, which were often the same people, you know, really wanted us to become a state. But finally, in 1846, our territorial governor, Henry Dodge, he finally pushed through this referendum on statehood. And so we finally agreed that we were ready to become a state. But then we had to write a constitution, which was another problem. You know, people thought, all right, we finally made it. We're finally going to become a state. And then they start writing a constitution in 1846. The constitution that they come up with is way too radical for people in Wisconsin at the time. One of the things that they decide on is that there's going to be no banks. There was a lot of distrust of banks at the time, so they decided that the solution was, you know, just don't even have them. You also weren't going to have money in denominations larger than a $20 bill. So that was another way to try to keep the money situation under control. They also were going to give immigrants who had applied for citizenship the right to vote. Now, Wisconsin, its population had grown so much in those first 10 years, largely on the backs of immigrants. Mm-hmm. You know, that was popular with immigrants, but not popular with some of the Yankees who had settled here in Wisconsin and were reluctant to give up some of their power to these immigrants. This first constitution gave the right to married women to own property, which was very radical. And they also were going to allow people in Wisconsin to vote on whether to give the vote to African Americans. So these were all very radical provisions for 1846. It's kind of surprising that they even came up with them. And so this was immediately turned down. People were not going to have any of that. So they sent them back to the drawing board and they called another constitutional convention and they came up with another constitution that was a lot more conservative, a lot more in line with other states. Women, no, you can't have property. Okay, maybe we'll have a few banks. And no, we're not going to allow African Americans to vote. This one was finally passed in 1848, and Wisconsin became a state in May of that year.
Was the state capital in Belmont then, or had it reverted to Madison?
It was actually in Madison. When the territorial legislature, when the territory was created in 1836, the territorial legislature met in Belmont for that first session. And one of the first things they had to decide was where their capital was going to be. And James Duane Doty, who was a land investor, judge, speculator, he had purchased a bunch of land here in Madison, and he kind of finagled the legislature to get Madison selected as the territorial capital, which mm-hmm. it became in 1836. And because he had bought all of the land, he stood to make a ton of money off of this deal. So when Wisconsin became a state, they agreed finally that Madison would continue to serve as the capital of the new state.
When the Wisconsin Historical Society Press was founded in 1855, 70% of the Norwegians in this country were living in Wisconsin.
That's right. Norwegians really loved Wisconsin.
Were they all farmers?
Yeah, a lot of them were farmers. Many of the Norwegians who came to the United States came from a farming background and were looking to settle in another farming location. And Norwegians, more than any other immigrants, it seems, Germans were somewhat susceptible to this too, seemed really swayed by a lot of the literature that was encouraging them to come to the United States. All kinds of city governments, state governments, immigration councils, railroad companies were encouraging immigrants to come to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
They printed pamphlets in all different languages. They sent them to the East Coast. They sent them to Europe, doing everything they really could to get people to come, because the more people you had in your town, the more chances your town had of making it. And Norwegians came in huge numbers, and the first came actually to Rock Island, Illinois, and then they started making their way north into Wisconsin. And for whatever reason, they tended to settle in areas where other Norwegians from their area of Norway settled. So if someone from your town came to you, Evansville, Wisconsin, and wrote home to say how amazing Evansville was, then you were likely to move to Evansville as well. So this is how all of these Norwegians ended up in Wisconsin. We had farming land that was available and other Norwegians, so they felt right at home.
We're talking with Erica Janik of Madison, the author of A Short History of Wisconsin. It is published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press. It's really a brand new book in that its major publication date is just a few days off.
That's right.
And congratulations to you for your upcoming wedding this week.
Thank you very much.
This Saturday.
That's right. I'm getting married on Saturday.
And going off to Europe in search of more history.
That's right. Definitely. Yeah. Every trip I ever go on is kind of historical. So I guess it makes sense that I ended up being a history writer. I can't remember a time in my life when I wasn't swayed by those brown signs promising a historic site at the next exit. So yeah, I'm sure my honeymoon will be filled with lots of history as well.
If you'd like to join the conversation about the short history of Wisconsin, a unique and welcoming place, the number for you is 1-800-642-1234. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jim Packard on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you with us today as we talk about the history of Wisconsin with Erica Janik. And Erica, thanks again for coming in to spend some time with us. The copper culture in Wisconsin, what was it and when did it happen?
The copper culture refers to this network of Indian trade that was happening all over North America between 3000 and 1200 BC. There was a lot of copper that was easily mined by Indians along the shores of Lake Superior. And they used to take this copper and they would make jewelry and tools. And they would trade this to people all over, from all the way from Canada to the Rocky Mountains down to the Gulf of Mexico. And this is what's generally referred to as the copper culture, because they were people that were making most of their implements out of copper. Copper was one of the first things, actually, that a lot of the French explorers first noticed about Wisconsin. When they were coming here, they were seeing all of these copper deposits along the shores of Lake Superior. But it's kind of surprising that the copper mining didn't actually really take off in Wisconsin until the late 19th century. Northern Wisconsin took a lot longer to get settled than southern Wisconsin. And so copper mining, beyond what was happening in the past, really didn't become a major industry until the late 19th century.
We're going to take some phone calls. We've got a line open for you at 1-800-642-1234. We'll start off with Nick in Green Bay. Hello, Nick.
Hi, I just got a question for you. Since you guys mentioned Evansville, Wisconsin.
Yep.
I was wondering if you knew anything about the Dish family down there. I heard that they're supposed to have been big politicians down there.
The Dish family? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
I don't know anything about them. What have you heard about them?
The only thing I know is my wife's grandpa was a big politician down there, and there's a park named after him down there, and that's about all I really know about it.
Hmm. Nope. We'll see if somebody else knows and can call in. Nick, thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you. William Dempster Hoard would have been in that area of Evansville, Fort Atkinson. Why is he still important today?
Well, William Dempster Hoard is the reason that we're America's Dairyland. He was a big proponent of dairy farming and dairying in Wisconsin. Wisconsin was actually not always America's Dairyland. We were actually America's breadbasket for the first part of the 19th century. We were a big wheat-growing state. And it really, that seemed like what our major cash crop was going to be. But then about the mid-19th century, there were some problems with growing wheat. There was a major infestation of a louse that kind of devastated the crops during the Civil War. And also, as more people were moving west to settle the plains, they were also growing wheat. And so, and it was kind of better conditions for growing wheat out there. So the prices started to drop, and the Wisconsin farmers just couldn't really compete. William Dempster Hoard, he had come to Wisconsin about 1857 from New York, and he had grown up in an area where he had seen that dairy farming could be very profitable for people. And so he looked around and he saw that wheat farming, that the crops were being destroyed by this bug and the low crop prices, and he thought, I think dairy is the answer. And so he started really tirelessly advocating dairy farming. He had dairy conferences. He formed the Wisconsin Dairymen's Association, which was the first dairy association of its kind in the country. He also started Hoard's Dairymen, which was a dairy farm publication that started in 1885 and is still in press today. He also worked with the University of Wisconsin to help get farmers trained. And he really introduced a lot of standards into it. It was hard for him to do, though. You know, farmers were really resistant. It's a big change to go from growing wheat to raising animals. But he managed to convince them that this was a profitable venture for them and that they could make this work. And I think it helped, too, that some of our immigrants that were starting to come were people that had come from dairying areas of the world, people that the Swiss that were, you know, big into making cheese. And so had people that could buy these products from dairy farms and use it to make other products. And he's really, like I said, the reason that we are America's Dairyland.
I had an email from Aaron in Stevens Point, who is wondering why the Wisconsin River is named after the state.
Because we weren't very creative. actually, the name Wisconsin is believed to be a French version of a Miami Indian word for the Wisconsin River. As the French were coming into Wisconsin, they were hearing what these Indians were calling different things, and they called the Wisconsin River something that sounded to them like Wisconsin, which in the Miami Indian language means river running through a red place. And so I think the river actually had the name before the state.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. We're talking with Erica Janik, the author of A Short History of Wisconsin, published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press. I also noted in a news release that you have either a blog or a website.
I have an anemic blog and a website with my... I'm very bad at keeping up my blog, but I do have a website that has a lot of my writing on it. I write for a number of publications, and so I tend to put the links up there so you can see more of what I've written about state history. I also do a lot of things on food and the environment, but Wisconsin history is a lot of what I'm interested in and what I tend to write about. Not being from Wisconsin, it's
yeah,
particularly helpful for me to learn.
And that's ericajanik.net?
Yep.
All right. And it's ericajanik.net. Let's go to Connie next in Portage. Hello, Connie. What's on your mind today?
Hello. I was wondering about the connection between the Kinsey family and Portage, and then how if they were some of the first ones to start Chicago.
I don't know about their connection to Chicago. I mean, they were a fur trading family, and Juliet Kinsey lived in that area. She wrote that book, Wah Bun, about living there and about the experiences there and what it was like to live in a trading post. But I'm not sure about the connection to Chicago. What do you know about that?
Well, I read two or three of the books of the Kinseys, and they ended up in Chicago. And it's been quite a while, maybe 20 years since I read them. And I was wondering if it seemed like they said they were some of the first ones to start Chicago. And I can't remember for sure. That's why I thought I'd ask you.
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, they did live in a time period that they could have been some of the first people to settle in Chicago. Chicago was settled around the same time as Wisconsin. And it was a major trading post. And having lived at a trading post, it would make sense that they would go down there. But I don't know for sure.
All right, Connie. Thanks very much. We appreciate your call. Maybe somebody will come up with an answer. The first brewery in Wisconsin, where was it located?
Well, there's some controversy about this, but generally, Owens Brewery in Milwaukee, which was started in 1840, is generally credited as being the first brewery in the state. But there is evidence that there were earlier breweries operating at Mineral Point and in Elk Grove. Breweries really grew very quickly in Wisconsin. Between 1848 and 1849, 12 new breweries opened. And by 1860, there were over 200 breweries in Wisconsin. 60 of them were in Milwaukee, which makes sense considering that that's where a lot of the German immigrants went to.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, every town in Wisconsin had a brewery by the late 19th century, and many towns even sprang up around these breweries. They were just a major part of community life and socializing, as well as a major industry for the state. The breweries were also kind of divisive, too. There was some tension between German immigrants, who were kind of the more fun-loving, wanted to have a good time and drinking, and some of their more stern Protestant Yankee settlers from New England and New York, who were less interested in drinking, less interested in the fun that kind of grew up around these breweries. And it created a lot of tension in early Wisconsin between these two groups. A lot of the Yankees that were in power were trying to kind of get rid of German culture, suppress it a little bit, because it was so anathema to what they believed people should be doing.
First hops in Wisconsin were planted where?
Don't know where the first hops were planted. Sauk County is like the major hop area of the state. There was a hops craze in the 1850s. Everyone was growing hops. The vast majority of them, I think it was almost 70% of the hops that were available in the United States, were coming from Sauk County for a couple of years. But who planted that first one? Who had the idea for that? I'm not exactly sure.
Mm-hmm. And why Sauk County, do you suppose?
I don't know. I think it was just an up-and-coming farming area. Land was kind of cheaper there. The two major areas of settlement in Wisconsin at first were in the lead mining region around Mineral Point, and then people were settling in Milwaukee. So that land in the middle took a while to settle, and it was generally cheaper. People kind of moved from those two areas into the middle. And so I think there was a new opportunity there. People probably weren't growing wheat there, and just a cheaper land.
Let's go to the phones again to Jerry and Abrams. Hello, go ahead.
Hi, guys. Great program. I was wondering if your guests could talk a little about the ancient copper culture that was discovered around O'Connell, Wisconsin. I believe it dates back a couple thousand years to the Native Americans. And I believe there's a festival this weekend in O'Connell, Wisconsin, Copper Culture Festival.
I think that's still part of the one that I mentioned that takes place between 3000 and 1200 BC. They were mining copper all over the state. The biggest and most obvious deposits were along the lake shores. But it was really, they were finding copper all over North America that native peoples were turning into tools and jewelry and any number of items that they were trading. And I think that must be what that festival is celebrating.
There is a program that Larry Mueller did with Tom Pleger, the dean and associate professor at the UW Sauk County, last summer, late or into fall. You can go back and search at WPR.org and go back and listen to that, because it deals with the copper culture directly and with a lot of information about that. Thanks very much for the call. Good luck to you. Let's go to Jeff in Superior next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning. This is a great show. I wanted to share with you that on my mother's side of the family, her grandmother, my great-grandmother, Hilma Bolander, was a servant of Martin Pattison up here in Superior. And, they had Fairlawn Mansion. She was a seamstress, sewing, she was a sewing expert for the family. And when she earned money, she sent it back to Sweden, where she was from, and brought over her brother and sister, who was later the carriage tender, took care of the horses. And then eventually they got married and moved to Canada. But she stayed here and met my great-grandfather, and, the rest is history.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. How did your family find out that? Is that something you've always known or something that you discovered later?
Well, from what I understand, my grandpa's sister, she wrote a book about the Bolanders. We actually had a reunion in Superior in the early 1970s, and that people came from Canada. They wrote a book about the, you know, the story goes back 100-some years.
Mm-hmm.
But the Pattison Mansion, actually, Fairlawn is free admission this year for people. They're trying to promote tourism up here in Superior.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And, of course, Pattison State Park, is, you know, the Pattison family donated that to the state. So
yeah.
It's a big part of the story here, but we're pretty proud of that connection, you know.
Jeff, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. We're talking with Erica Janik, the author of A Short History of Wisconsin, and the telephone number for you to join in is 800-642-1234. John in Sun Prairie asks on email, how did you decide what to include in your book and what to leave out?
It's a very hard decision. I mean, I'm tend to find everything interesting, so it was very hard. I mean, I think, you know, I really had to keep in mind that I wanted this to be a short history of Wisconsin. There's a really wonderful series called The History of Wisconsin that's 6 volumes. It's published by the Historical Society, but each volume is a doorstop, a great book, but, you know, each is 600 pages long. And so, you know, I didn't want to go to that end of the spectrum. I really tried to look at the things that I thought were the key moments in our state history, things that I thought were, you know, had a lasting impact on the state. Things I really wanted to be inclusive to of Native Americans and women. You know, one of the things I find the most interesting about Wisconsin is one of our first school teachers is Electa Quinney, who is a Native American woman, and she ran one of the first public schools. I find that very interesting. I didn't want, you know, a person like that to be left out of the story. So it really was a difficult process of picking and choosing. And, you know, there's definitely things that I've left out.
Thanks very much for the call. We appreciate your email. And let's go next to, I'm sorry, this is, see if Wayne is still here. Al Wayne?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Thanks. My question is, why isn't the Upper Peninsula of Michigan part of Wisconsin? And also, the southern border is like, what, 50, 60 miles north of the tip of Lake Michigan?
Mm-hmm.
Why doesn't it go straight across from the tip of Lake Michigan?
Well, that, yes, you are right about that. Chicago is actually supposed to be in Wisconsin. The Northwest Ordinance set from 1787, which determined how states were going to, how the state boundaries were going to be drawn, they specified that any of these western states, the line would be drawn straight across from the tip of Lake Michigan, as you said, straight across. So that means that Chicago, Galena, these cities would all be in Wisconsin today. But in 1818, when Illinois was going to become a state, the North and the South were wrestling for who was going to have a free state and who was going to have a slave state. So in order to compensate for an imbalance in the ratio of free to slave states, they decided that they would move the border of Illinois northward because they thought then Illinois would have a port on Lake Michigan, which would then help them develop ties to the north. And then this way, you know, hopefully they wouldn't be swayed to become a slave state. So because there were not very many people, not very many white people living in Wisconsin at the time, they just decided to do it anyway. And so regardless of the Northwest Ordinance, they decided to move the border northward, gave all of that land to Illinois. And, you know, it appeared to work in the Civil War because Illinois did stay with the North, as they had hoped, when Illinois became a state and gave us Lincoln. As for the UP, that's kind of a story that I... there doesn't seem to be a definitive answer there. It's, again, you know, about wrestling for control of territory. I've heard multiple versions of the story about compensating for imbalances in Ohio by giving Michigan land up north. I'm not actually sure what the right answer is. It seems to be, again, another land grab situation of wrestling for political loyalties by giving over land in which few citizens were living in at the time, and they thought that they could just hand over more pieces of land.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, Wayne, thank you for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. And Brian is next in Platteville. Hello, Brian.
Hello, good morning.
Yes, sir.
I am a Cornish descendant of Cornish immigrants in southwestern Wisconsin. And, you know, growing up in school around here, everyone's German, Norwegian. I'm Norwegian, too. But, like, where did all the Cornish people gone? Did they all go out to California during the gold rush, or?
A lot of them did. After lead mining started to decline in Wisconsin, and when gold was discovered in the West, almost all of them did move. A few of them went north and started mining copper, actually, and some of the iron ore, but most of them did move on. They were not. A lot of the Cornish settlers, especially the ones that came just to mine, came looking for work. They weren't looking to settle in a new place and make, you know, put down roots. They were just looking to make a living and to go where the work was. And, you know, they came to Wisconsin because that's where the work was. And then they moved on to where other mining opportunities were as they arose.
Okay, that just sounds really weird because, like, my family, my great-great-grandfather was a boy when he came over. And then he settled here. He built a house and it's been in the family for five generations now. It was built in 1866, and it's like the only Cornish people left.
You were one of the few who stayed behind.
Yeah, I tell people I'm a quarter Cornish.
All right, Brian, good luck. Thanks very much. Let's try Lynn in Lake Forest, Illinois. Hello, Lynn.
Hi there, Jim. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I'm calling because I'm remembering notes that were kept by my great aunt on my father's side. In a journal, she lived in Sun Prairie all of her life. Her name was Lena Conry Fuller, and she wrote about her parent, well, her mother, coming with her mother's parents to Sun Prairie, establishing Sun Prairie back in 1844. They came from Somerset, New York, must have been a group, and they came to Milwaukee. And they set out going west, obviously, with a team of oxen and along a plank road. Might have been, if it were in existence at that time, what is called the Watertown Plank Road.
Mm-hmm.
And they traveled for, seems to me, like 6 days in rain and ruts.
Yep.
And on the seventh, they arrived at somewhere where the sun shone, finally, and they just decided to stay there and call it Sun Prairie.
I love that story. I've heard that, too. I've read some of the accounts, too, and they talk about it being up to their knees in mud. They just never thought they would get there, just trudging through the rain for days and days, and like, why did I come to this place? And then all of a sudden, they got to this beautiful flat area, and the sun came out, and they decided to call it Sun Prairie.
Oh, I'm so glad to have, you know, those notes corroborated.
Yep,
thank
that's
you.
Definitely right.
Thank you.
All right, Lynn, thank you very much. And Scott in Dodgeville, let's go to you. And there you are. Hi, go ahead.
Yes, I'm wondering what information you have on the, I believe it's called the Villa Louis and Fred Sheen and the man who built that being a fur trader and what his name is.
Yeah, that was built by the Dousman family. His name is Hercules Dousman. He was a fur trader for the American Fur Trade Company. That was his family house that he built out there in Prairie du Chien. It's actually a historic site. I don't know if you've ever been there, but you can go visit it. It's owned by the Wisconsin Historical Society. It was one of the grandest homes in Wisconsin when it was built in the 1880s. It's still a beautiful home. It was recently restored in the last couple of years. They've just back to the 1880s. And yes, that was a major fur trading area. It was right on the Mississippi River. There's a fur trade museum there where you can learn all about the fur trade on the Mississippi. It was a major transit route, and that was one of the richest families in Wisconsin.
Now, what a question is, I have on my abstract, I have this man owning the property that I owned, I believe, back in like 1836 or 34 or so, before Wisconsin was a state, and it's showing how the transactions were all done in the state of Illinois at the time. And I just wonder where it shows that he owned different properties in the state before it was a state.
He did, yeah. His family has actually been in the area. The Dousman family was operating fur trade posts down in Illinois. Galena was another major fur trade area. And so, yeah, it's not surprising to me that you saw some kind of land deed that mentioned he owned parcels of land all over. They made a ton of money off the fur trade that allowed them to build that beautiful house later in their life, but also to have just a very profitable enterprise.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much. And Jillian in Suamico gets the last question. Go ahead.
Hello. I would just like to share some ancestral Wisconsin history. I know that I'm a fifth generation of Thomas McCallan, who was the first white settler in the Oconto area after the Civil War. He was a medic and then became known as the country doctor. And my family still owns property on the Oconto River where he had his home. And as a child, I would go into that haunted house, and we all had retirement or summer homes. My daughter, Allison, is named after the first white child woman born, you know, in that area of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. That's a great story.
That's a great story.
Oh, and lastly, I wanted to say that we were recognized with the centennial. I can't remember what year, might have been in the 80s, as the founding family of that area in the celebration. And that mountain is located where he settled off of Highway 32 North and or south of Lakewood, you may have heard of.
Jillian, thank you. Thank you so much for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. And one last question for you is Increase Lapham. Why is he important in the state's history?
Well, Lapham is one of those wonderful 19th century polymaths. He did everything. He was a historian. He was a naturalist. He was a scientist. He came to Wisconsin when it became a territory in 1836, and he really just started investigating and taking note of everything. He was one of the first people to systematically measure and investigate the Indian effigy mounds. He warned the territorial legislature that we needed to do something to protect our trees. He really advised the state legislature to conduct a natural history survey so we could record all of the plants and animals that were living here before they got destroyed. He was really just this wonderful person who saw Wisconsin as this beautiful, wonderful place that needed to be protected decades, even a century before anyone else was even advocating these things.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to be talking about the short history of Wisconsin. A new book by Erika Janik, E-R-I-K-A-J-A-N-I-K, of Madison, published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press. And, of course, you can go to her website at erikajanik.net. Again, congratulations to you. And
thank you.
Hope the ceremony goes off this weekend without a hitch.
Thank you so much.
If you'd like a CD of the program, it's available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.